Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry. In 1998, Scott Ladner hit the derivative scene at First Union. Just as LTCM was imploding and equity volatility was rocketing higher. No sooner would the Fed help contain that risk episode than the tech bubble would be set in motion. An intense period of stocks up, vol up, during which valuations expanded to unheard of levels, followed by an equally intense stocks down, vol up, characterized the period from 1999 to 2001 and provided Scott with sometimes painful lessons in managing convexity risk. Short airline volatility during the September 11th terrorist attack, Scott quickly came to appreciate the potential for significant gap risk and discontinuity in markets, a reality not contemplated in the textbook version of Black-Scholes. My conversation with Scott considers insights gathered over career managing volatility exposure across asset classes and how he came to his role as CIO of Horizon Investments. Scott shares his views on how volatility can come and go, how many factors can come to impact the price of options, and how important it is to have a number of little bets on versus being overly concentrated in a singular exposure. He points to the value, but also the dangers of option models, learning along the way not to take the output too seriously and to constantly re-examine the assumptions being made. Today, Scott's dashboard consists of credit, liquidity, and risk metrics with the goal of identifying incongruities that help him focus his research to better understand market dynamics. In this context, we discuss the early and late year vol events of 2018. Lastly, we discuss Horizon's efforts on behalf of its clients to manage wealth and retirement goals within the constraints of the low growth and low interest rate environment. His team is seeking to build risk management techniques that work specifically in today's unique economic and financial climate. Noting that there is now an ETF for everything, he sees the last 10 years as the age of product. The next 10, in contrast, he views as the age of planning, where the focus should be on how to best utilize these new products to maximize the wealth and overall experience of retirement for individuals. Please enjoy this episode of the Alpha Exchange, my conversation with Scott Ladner. My guest today on the Alpha Exchange is Scott Ladner. He is the CIO of Horizon Investments. Scott, it's great to be in North Carolina in your office. It's great to have you on the podcast.
I appreciate it, Dean.
Such an interesting background you have. I'd love to start with how you began your career in the industry. I know you've seen lots of market wars and have traded across lots of different asset classes, but take us through the early days of your career. When did you start and how did you develop a passion for finance?
Yeah, I mean, it did start pretty early with me. I started my first job, I think it was 8 days after graduating college, what was then First Union National Bank, on the derivatives desk, run by a guy named Steve Colhagen, kind of one of the authors of the text version of the Black-Scholes model, basically. Super awesome teacher, really nice guy. That was 1998. So it was sort of Wild Wild West time in terms of derivatives land. I think in the entire group, there was 100 of us or so. So it was a cool learning opportunity to kind of get into an equity derivatives unit that was really just started only about 3 months before I got there.
So this is 1998, it's long-term capital, you're kind of a year after the Asian crisis, and in large measure, the equity options markets were more retail-focused, certainly had not seen the massive technology investment, which would take us to where we are now in terms of electronic trading and so forth. What was your specific role as you joined the desk in 98?
That first year, I was kind of a hybrid sales trading guy as I sort of learned the trading ropes. And then I took over both the prop and a customer OTC option book and vol books. I traded equity vol on behalf of customers and on a prop basis. I also started a risk arb and special situations book with a guy named Andy Henry, who was basically the guy that trained me, and started basically a Delta One kind of swap and total return swap business for the bank back then too. So wore a bunch of different types of hats, which was ended up being really fun. Learn a lot of different types of markets. I mean, traded like mandatories for a little while. Just kind of wherever we could find some edge as we were kind of allowed to go wherever we needed to, which made it kind of a lot of fun.
So it's a while ago. It's 20 years ago. Of course, we're pre.
Thanks.
Yeah. Well, I was before that as myself.
No.
But we're pre-negative rates. We're pre-QE. were before a lot of things. We're certainly 10 years before the absolute biggest financial event that most of us have ever seen, the financial crisis itself. What were the insights that you developed along the way of the early days of you market making Vol? You mentioned you had your hands in other products that are related to Vol, things like mandatory convertibles. What stands out to you as kind of impactful to the growth of you as a professional and sort of how you framed your understanding of how to manage option risk?
One is getting slapped in the face with humility over and over and over again. Like, kind of when you think you got to figure it out, you figure out fairly quickly that you don't. That's something that I don't know how you learn it other than just through experience. But certainly 9/11 was one of those for me. I was not personally, but my book was short. Airline Gamma, that was part of the positions that we had. That was obviously troubling. That was humility producing. Trade a lot of Enron stuff through that. That was also humility producing. And just understanding how volatility can come and go really, really quickly. So I remember being selling some Cisco Vol in like the 60s, 3 month Cisco Vol in the 60s, and just thinking this is going to be a huge loser. We were being asked to do it to try to balance the book out a little bit. And looking back, that like what a silly thing to be worried about. But you don't know what you don't know at that point. And so all of it's a bit of a learning experience. And all of it's like just figuring out that, hey, there's a lot more going on here than just trading this little idiosyncratic thing called volatility and trying to kind of manage a book. Learning an appreciation for the different cross currents of things that can affect how you think about the world. And that's something that I'm still working with and still working on. But just trying to get a broader perspective on what can actually matter in the world in terms of how you think about your positioning, how you think about your book, how you think about your portfolio and kind of what the risks are to it. It's just going to be broader than you think it is pretty much all the time.
I'm thinking back to 98 to 2002, let's say, and that's a kind of a tight window, but a lot happened with, as we said, started with LTCM. We had the turn of the year, some Y2K concerns that kind of blew over. Of course, the tragedy of 9/11. There was a kind of the unwind of the internet bubble, probably kind of finished in 2002. You had firms like Tyco and Adelphia and WorldCom, some were outright fraud, but some massive vol events and widening credit spreads. And then in the kind of early part of that period, you had the internet bubble itself, which was this fascinating period. And I'd love for you to share some thoughts on this. This was the ultimate stocks up, vol up. You had this expansion of these valuations to the stratosphere. We hadn't seen things like that before. And it's almost like the stocks themselves became options. How did you manage risk through that period where stocks were going up, but volatility was expanding so much along the way?
Well, I mean, it taught you that you needed to have, at least if you're trying to manage through a period like that, when things are like they had never been, especially when things are like they have never been, you can't take a whole lot of deep concentrated bets. What that period specifically taught me, at least, was just the importance of having kind of a portfolio that's an inch deep and a mile wide sort of idea. Just have a lot of little bets on, because the probability that you're going to get the big stuff right, or a whole bunch of big stuff right, is pretty low, just because you don't really have any history to go on, and the dynamics that are driving the stuff that's going on are probably pretty complicated. And so just having a lot of little bets on where you have a little bit of edge across a lot of different types of things ended up being the safest way to build portfolios and manage risk through that. That'd be one lesson. And the other lesson was, models are only going to be so good as the guys kind of building them and running them. So understanding where they're definitely going to be wrong. Just the standard Black-Scholes thing where of continuous prices, that doesn't work with biotech stocks. It didn't work in the late 90s with internet stocks, because things just gapped. And discontinuity prices was the norm, not the exception. And so models that assumed that there were continuous prices were going to give you bad Greeks. They're going to give you bad risk numbers. And so there's a little bit of art that goes into managing portfolios like that as well. I mean, just some healthy skepticism about the math. We don't deal in, as much as kind of the math would make you think, we don't deal in natural sciences here. We're dealing, these are not natural laws. These things are not immutable, and the world can change. And so just having an appreciation for that stuff and having the ability to understand where the assumptions were and kind of how they might impact how you would manage risk inside of a book or inside of a portfolio, it served us pretty well to figure out that, hey, listen, I maybe need to take a broader perspective on this. I maybe need to not believe the model precisely on every single little thing that it's telling me. Just use some intuition. Have a little bit of wisdom about it. And don't be so beholden to all the Greek letters on the page.
Right. A single number spits out of the Black-Scholes model. It feels very neat and tidy. But of course, as you say, it's only as good as the assumptions. And we assume this normal distribution. We assume sort of constancy of vol. We, in some ways, assume that liquidity is always there. And so none of these seems to hold up in reality. You had mentioned before we started that one of your roles, I think, in the early 2000s was also managing rate vol, swaption vol book. I'd love you to walk us through that. Plenty for us to sort of juxtapose you running that book versus how someone has to run a book now where you have literally negative rates in some areas of the world. What was that position like for you?
That was a huge learning curve as well. And by the way, thank God I don't have to do that job anymore. That's a hard job, man. Going from doing an equity, from like being an equity vol guy, like still a risk neutral guy, but still on the equity space, to being a rate vol guy is a really big change. And probably the biggest change that people don't always appreciate is just the fundamental nature of how skew is different. Skew in rates is totally different than how skew works in the equity market. Like, skew is all the way to the put side in equities, as it should be. People are long $50 trillion worth of something. Protection against that thing going bad is going to be expensive. I mean, it's just supply-demand stuff, right? Outside of everything else. Rate skew isn't always one-sided. It's like it's symmetric about zero in general. And it's been a little bit different more recently. But just the idea that skew can kind of be different and it's really difficult to model and it's difficult to kind of know which way it's going was probably one of the biggest lessons that I learned from that, trying to manage that portfolio, because it was a bit of a beast.
And so what was the time period that you were?
That was like 03 to 04, somewhere in that general range. I'm not
okay.
sure exactly.
So I'm thinking Fed funds are, we started tightening after the Greenspan deflation concerns. We got all the way up to about 5.25%, I think, in funds. So we're probably in the 4-5%.
When Greenspan had that measured language in the statement, it was through that period of time.
Right. When you think about the skew in rates, and it's such an interesting phenomenon for folks in the equity land to contemplate, which is, as you say, rightly always towards the put in equities. What do you think drives the skew in swaptions in rates? Is it some version of positioning? Is it how the central bank guides you? What do you think are the sort of proximate causes of pushing the skew one way or the other?
Just supply demand. In that market, it is going to be mostly supply demand driven. If you have everybody wanting exposure to rates going up or wanting exposure to rates going down, however that ends up looking, that is the, at least in my experience, that was the dominant driver of kind of what swung skew kind of metrics around. That being said, people didn't trade a whole lot of skew-based things. It was still a lot of at-the-money, it's or at-the-money forward kind of contracts, at least when I was doing it. But and the size was just gigantic, too. I mean, like, that was the other thing that really struck me is a round lot for that world is $100 million notional. Like, that's a big number in an equity land is kind of this, like I said, it's kind of a round lot in the swaption land.
And so in terms of the kind of supply and demand dynamics for rate vol back then, my understanding is the GSEs were big players in the market hedging their mortgage portfolios. Was there a lot of activity on the macro hedge fund side? What were the common trades? What were people trying to accomplish?
That portfolio in particular was, and I don't know if this is true for all sell side shops at that time, but we traded mostly with other sell side shops. Okay. It wasn't really a customer facing book. It was mostly just trading against other sell side guys. So like I said, I'm not sure if that experience is consistent, like either through time or across kind of cross-sectionally across different firms, but certainly that was the way that we ended up getting set up.
Was there a vol risk premium that was noticeable as we typically have seen in equities?
You know, it's interesting. I've actually studied that some, and there's not. There's really not a vol risk premium inside the interest rate space. It's not entirely clear to me why that's the case, but it is neither persistent nor really there most of the time. It's realized kind of equals implied, and it holds. It'll be there occasionally, but it's not as persistent like it is in equity land.
Another area of focus in the period leading into and during the crisis, what was the period up to the crisis like for you?
I went up to Chicago for a little bit and worked at a firm up there on the vol side, on the equity vol side. And then I came back down to Charlotte to try to start a little firm of my own. In the process of doing that, we actually met the folks at Horizon. Leading up to the crisis, I was actually had a little joint partnership with Horizon Investments, like my firm and Horizon Investments. That had to do with a protection algorithm that we developed. That ended up being a pretty interesting little business, but that's really what I was doing kind of leading into the crisis and through the crisis was working on this kind of joint venture with Horizon on the protection side of things. It's kind of like a liquid structured note, if you think about that.
Big observations from the crisis. What point did you and your team realize this is something totally different? What were the kind of eureka type moments during that period?
when AT&T bonds were trading $60 on the dollar. You know, it was really when credit markets crashed and equity markets didn't really respond. It was like, oh, this is different. Like, this is definitely very weird. I'm not sure why we're not getting sort of cross-asset agreement, but we definitely weren't. You know, money markets were behaving very differently than equity markets. Credit markets were behaving very differently than equity markets. And I don't know if people were just thinking it would blow through or blow over or just wouldn't really matter. The 08 period was, it was like, I'm not going to say it was a predictable crash, but at least it wasn't a total surprise in terms of what happened with equity markets then. Now, it got worse than I think people generally thought. There's probably a lot of things going into that. But it definitely took away from that period of time. Just pay attention to other asset classes. They may tell you something about what's going on. When they disagree, one's not always right, one's not always wrong, but you better figure out what they're saying and incorporate that into your view. That's definitely by far the biggest thing that I learned out of that crisis. And then a greater appreciation for the role of liquidity. In the late 90s and early and mid-2000s, liquidity was fine. Like, it didn't really ever come up. You didn't think about it that much. And certainly in 08 and 08 and 09, you thought about it a lot. And it came into the risk models. It came into the way you thought about positioning. It came into the way you were building portfolios. It had to, because it mattered a ton. Like, if you couldn't realize it, who cares? And so the cross-asset dynamics of understanding how markets are functioning and the appreciation, the greater appreciation for how liquidity worked, were probably the two biggest things that I at least personally took out of that episode.
I've always bought a lot into the Minsky instability hypothesis, which is some version of quiet markets self-destruct ultimately. And there wasn't, maybe outside of 2017, a quieter market than 2005 and 2006. I think there was a four-year period where the S&P did not have a 2% move on a single day. And it's that reinforcement of the profits that come from accruing carry, of being short vol and sort of earning these nickels along the way and not getting hit. And then I think I'd love to get your take on this. The narrative in the pre-crisis period was a lot of backslapping on the central bank's part, where they were very excited about the great moderation. They felt like they had tamed the business cycle. I remember reading reports from the IMF saying that we have essentially facilitated through financial innovation the dispersion of credit risk. It's a safer system. And it was really anything but that. What are your views on just that side of things? How much of the crisis was preventable? Were there policy mistakes? Is it once in a lifetime? Are we apt to repeat something like this?
I think the only thing I can say with certainty is that it's not going to be the same way again. The same thing's not going to happen again. Like, it's not going to unfold the same way. 87 was different from 01, 02 was different from 08, it was different from the 7. You know, like, all these things are going to be fundamentally different. We certainly have some opinions about what may be the next one, but it's, well, we don't think it's anywhere really very close. The 08 crisis was, yeah, I mean, you're right. Everybody was sort of slapping each other on the backs. It was a kind of a good feel-good time leading up to it. And there were some fundamental misunderstandings for how things were working. But it was inevitable. Probably somewhat, just because of the leverage involved. And just because there just didn't need to be very much to happen to tip a firm like Lehman over or tip a firm, you know, firm like Bear over. Like, if you're 30 or 41 levered on equity side, it just doesn't take very much. And so it's, without that type of leverage, that crisis doesn't unfold that way. And like, there may be still a subprime reckoning, but it's not going to unfold the way that it did. And so the absent, you know, we just don't have that kind of leverage in the system right now. And so absent that, like, it's tough to see a cascading type of crisis unfold, at least in the next 6 to 12 months. I mean, never say, there will be something at some point, but we don't think it's imminent on the horizon.
Right. So one lesson from the crisis for you seems to be liquidity and the way in which it can evaporate. And the preparedness that people had going into that crisis, if you were well prepared, you could really save your firm, save your P&L. But there's also a risk, and I'd love to get your take on this, of overpaying for protection. As we started to emerge from the freeze of the crisis in early 2009, the VIX was still at 50. And so for the better part of many, many years afterwards, vol has essentially been an underperforming asset. We only look at the time series of the VXX as an example for the power of roll down against what you're fighting. What lessons do you have in terms of the being long or short volatility? How do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I think it absolutely depends on what you're trying to do. Again, that sounds kind of trite, but if you're running an absolute return portfolio, then generally the right way to be short volatility. Running a long-only portfolio is generally the right way to be long volatility. What are you promising your investors with a particular product that's in play? Because whatever you're promising them, like you need your option strategy needs to be consistent with that. For instance, like we have some protection-based strategies here. Those protection-based strategies, we will never sell an equity put. It just won't do it. Like even though it's the right thing to do over long periods of time, the risk of being wrong at the wrong time and producing an outcome which is inconsistent with the expectations for that product swamps it. It makes no sense. And so the strategies that you employ just need to be consistent with the promises that the product is trying to deliver. It's not always what is right. It's just what's right for that product at that time. This is really kind of how we think about that stuff.
So through the crisis, you first established a joint venture with Horizon. Take us through that post-crisis period and how you came to your current role as CIO.
Yeah, we ended up just figuring out that it was the better thing just to roll that company into Horizon. So we did that in 2010 and took a position in the firm with some equity. And over the years, I held a bunch of different types of roles in the firm, ran the quant side, kind of ran the risk management side, and had the CIO role for the last couple of years. It's a fun group of folks. I can say that unabashedly because the people that we work with and do the investment management here especially are like super wicked smart. But everybody comes to the problem from a very different starting place. So the backgrounds that we have some FX volatility guys. We have guys that starts with rates and like that's his starting place. We have a guy that starts like as a fundamental stock picker and that's his starting place. I'm more of a kind of listed derivatives guy, more cross assets. That's my starting place. We have a bunch of people that start from different starting places and try to form an opinion about what's going on in the markets. And that to me was a super fun place to work and a super fun thing to be a part of because everybody's pretty smart. There's no jerks around. And you can be informed by other people's expertise in a very fast environment and come to conclusions, especially if you think that cross-asset dynamics matter, you can come to conclusions about what's going on in the world in a, we think, a pretty efficient manner. It certainly informs the way I think about the world, like what these other guys are telling me.
So I think the linkages across these different asset classes, which may not seem obviously important, I think we agree, can be really meaningful. It can give you insights about where the pressure points might be. And we've seen a lot of these sort of more random type of events start to spill back, let's say, to U.S. equities, Brexit, the China sort of quasi-deval in August of, what was that, 2015. We've seen these events really matter. How do you pay attention to those? Is it through option prices? What are the types of things that you, what's the Scott Ladner dashboard of risk look like?
I do kind of break the world down into either risk metrics, credit metrics, or liquidity metrics. And I have a bunch of different things I look at that all fall into one of those three broad categories. A lot of the things that I look at are somehow derivatives-based, just because that's how I interpret the world. Just seeing what is behaving anomalously. So like, is credit behaving differently than liquidity metrics than like repo markets or something like that? Or is FX vol behaving markedly differently than equity vol? Is anything out of place is really what it comes down to. And if something's out of place, that at least gives you a direction to focus your research on. The world is too vast. There's too much to look at if you try to look at everything all the time. We use these kind of screens and these kind of tools and these models that we built that just point out, say, hey, this is out of place relative to some version of history, however you want to define that. And that at least lets us focus some effort and some research on whatever is out of place and say, it's here for a reason or it's here for or it's not. Then what's that telling us? That can tell you about something about positioning. That can tell you something about how people are pricing different events. That can tell you something about valuations or anything else. But at least it gives you a shot to focus your research on something that has a, what we think has a chance to be valuable.
Right. I was curious about 2017. It's this incredibly low vol period. I think the realized vol was 6.5% for the S&P. And it's very difficult as a fund manager. I'm curious if you can describe how Horizon would fit into this. But a lot of these fund managers have a very explicit, either a benchmark that is, it's passive. That's it. This is what we do. It doesn't really matter what the price is. We're buying. Or if it's not passive, it's quasi-passive. There is, in the words of Howard Marks, a lot of benchmark hugging. And so if the market's going up and you're not long enough of it, your business is at risk. I think you guys have a more flexibility in that benchmarking. But I'm curious, like on 2017, what are the factors that create such a low vol outcome? Because that was incredibly sideways market went up 20% and the realized vol was 6.5. You just don't really see that very often. What do you think was going on there?
So this is post-Trump. So Trump gets elected and there's an immediate whipsaw, real hard. And then there came to be a realization that you can think whatever you want to about him personally or about his policies are constructive of risk assets, broadly speaking. And so when that became realized, people were generally underinvested, and you just saw kind of a slow drip of money coming into the markets. There ended up not being much to worry about. You know, the Fed was predictable, like global central banks were predictable. We didn't have any flare-ups geopolitically to speak of in 2017. We thought we knew what we were getting policy-wise, even if we had something erratic on the personality side. We thought we knew what we were getting policy-wise. Earnings were coming off the trough, kind of the earnings recession from late 15, early 16. They were kind of heading in the right direction. There just wasn't a whole lot of things to disrupt the apple cart. And so inertia took over and it just drove the entire year. And it got exacerbated in January of 18. And you know, we kind of know how that ended in early February. But the coalescence of a whole lot of things that people thought they understood very well. And so if you understand stuff very well and, and your opinion doesn't change about it, you have no reason to trade or change your positions. And that's really what it felt like in most of 2017.
Yesterday was one of these rare days where stocks fell and bond prices fell as well. And I was looking at the last time we had a joint move of that magnitude was February 2nd of 2018. So it was the Friday before XIV
and
event.
And payrolls, the inflation scare.
And the inflation scare, yes. So bond yields were going up and the stock market took notice and started to get quite concerned. Walk us through the risk management process that you guys used here, let's say in January and February of 2018, identifying that maybe something untoward was potentially going to occur, having it realized, seeing the fallout, liquidity got hit pretty hard during that period. How do you manage risk and protect capital during that period?
You alluded to this earlier that our benchmarks for us is a goofy thing. We're a goals-based manager. That means that's a very different conversation than more of a traditional benchmark kind of manager. We have strategies that try to accomplish different things in different ways. But writ large, the way we kind of some of our flagship-y strategies manage risk through that period, we actually got a little bit fortunate. We did have some hedges in place based on some of the dynamics of the VIX ETNs that we thought were fragile that ended up working fairly well through that period. But again, it's never going to happen the same way again. You know, we get that. We're fortunate to have those positions on in place. But it was one of those just like, hey, we see some fragility out there. We think that this kind of risk is mispriced. The run up in January was all you have to do is just look at the chart. Like the angle changed. Right, the angle changed. And it changed a lot in January from pretty much all of 2017. And it was a relatively historic January out of 1 month. And we're like, listen, there's, I don't know, was it 10 or 11% in January? It's like, it's for our business, for our customers' portfolios, for what these are trying to do for our clients in a goals-based framework, it's the right thing to put some protection in place after a January like that. And so we did. And it worked out okay. But it's one of those where if we hadn't had that January run-up, like we probably wouldn't have done that type of positioning. So it's just being aware of what the portfolio positions are at any point in time and what they're doing relative to the expectational certainty that we try to provide with these products, what they're trying to do for our clients ultimately, and just having that in the back of our head when we're trying to manage them.
It's always difficult to disentangle cause and effect. Folks like us spend a lot of time trying to do it. I'm convinced that there's a lot of narrative fallacy where we ascribe this was what happened and this is why it happened. It's a human condition to need to understand, especially for folks in finance. But in that period, and I love the angle change because it really did change in January, we were up a tremendous amount on a very low vol. It was forceful. And it was one of these stocks up, vol up periods where you noticeably saw implied vol going up even as the market rose. And I'm just wondering if it was this sort of cascading of capital getting stuffed into carry that just ultimately sowed the seeds of its own demise. I mean, how do you think about that period leading into the XIV? Because it got bigger and bigger. We know the leverage constraints that it has. It's mechanically forced to do something. We know how low vol was and how big the futures hedge that it needed to trade in VIX was. But you also had things like you said, there was, I think the market was glued to hourly earnings.
Look, this market can't take higher rates. Like that's fairly clear. And so when that number came through, people got a little spooked and it acted appropriately. But you're right. Like it was a case where the boat had gotten sufficiently full. Everybody was on the same side of it. you kind of, it was trading like that. You kind of, like you said, spot up, ball up is one indication of it kind of trading like that, where everybody's sort of same way. And look, when everybody's same way, we know where the pain is. And tough part is you can't ever call the timing on it. It can stay that way for a long time. Right. It just so happened that this one had a spark. The kindling had been there for a little bit, but this one had a spark. And it was a spark of the inflation scare. But you still ultimately need the spark to happen, even with, because that dry tinder can sit there for a very long time. And you can run out of budget.
You were prescient and fortunate to have these VXX type hedges on in the period leading into this and through its occurrence. But by most people's rendering, the VXX and VIX just got way too high relative to everything else. It was a VIX event. Yes. So how do you think about, okay, now I've got this thing, it's made me money, but it's probably too high. It's got the potential to lose money very quickly. How do you think about monetization and sort of hanging in there on your hedges?
Oh, yeah. No, we did not hang in there. Okay. These we wanted to eliminate as fast as we could because, you know, Dean, you're right. It was a very VIX-centered event, and it was not being confirmed by any other cross-asset metrics we were looking at. It wasn't confirmed by really anything. It just was, this was a market dynamic, a kind of a microstructure kind of thing that was going on that we didn't feel was going to play through to other assets. And so we tried to get out of the hedge as quickly as we could. Frankly, I learned a little bit of a lesson out of the Brexit experience. You know, we had some VIX-based hedges going through Brexit, and we tried to get a little too cute about monetizing them and didn't do as well as we should have. Did okay, but could have done very well. And that was like, we're always learning this stuff. Been doing it for a long time, 20-something years, but you still learn. You'll get slapped around sometimes by some bad decisions and are trying to be too cute about stuff. Like, if it works, just blow out of it. Get out. You did what you're trying to do. Don't try to get too cute. Don't try to make the last nickel. Just get out, count your blessings, and kind of move on to the next thing.
If Q1 and Feb of 18 was really a part of the market centered in VIX and the products built around it, specific to that, Q4 of 18 is broader. It seems to have entangled the Fed and the Fed's potentially careless sort of communication in the market. That last December tightening the market probably didn't need. There was some signs of economic weakness that the market was worried about. Of course, trade as an overriding concern. Walk us through that period. The S&P traveled through a fair amount of index points there. I think 15 to 20%. VIX didn't get super high outside of, I think it was December 24th. So it was a very different sort of vol event, although the equity market lost a lot.
No, totally right. It was a very different vol event, which is why VIX hedges can be challenging sometimes. They may not work as expected, and that's the worst thing you possibly have happen is from a hedging standpoint. But no, the Q4 market was, we think it was largely driven by two things. It was systematic. You know, people were generally pretty full positionally. The systematic, the trend follower guys, risk parity guys, vol targeting guys all needed to sell into a pretty bad liquidity tape in December. But it was punctuated by, I think you highlighted right, Dean, just the complete confusion on communication from the Fed. Think of where we've gone over the last 12 months. Like last December, we had a Fed, Powell could not communicate his way out of a wet paper bag. I mean, it was disastrous. Every time he opened his mouth, it was something different. And I've got a theory on it. Like I think he was communicating at that time the wishes and the desires of the committee that he did not hold personally. And so like his communication style on the pressers was abysmal, incredibly frustrating. And so people just didn't know what to expect. But if you listen to his speeches during that time, when he wasn't trying to defend the committee's actions or wishes, he was actually pretty clear. But the communication from the pressers was the market just couldn't get hold of him, couldn't get a beat on the guy and acted appropriately. So the liquidity environment in middle to late December, we all know, is pretty wretched. That didn't help things. But it ultimately wasn't. There wasn't anything really, really bad going on. It just was, we don't understand this Fed communication right now, and we have a really bad tape, and we got some forced selling. Who knows how much, but it was definitely some forced selling associated with it, conspired to have a pretty nasty fourth quarter. But those conditions, we don't think those conditions are here right now. Like, it's a very different time in 2019 than we had in December 2018.
One of the things that I think we talked about was this incredibly low FX vol, where if you just think about the ECB and the Fed, both have essentially created their own form of forward guidance. Nothing's going to happen for a while. And I think that that creates some stability in these currency relationships. What about on the equity side as we kind of balance out the year here? Very different from a year ago, but still some concerns on trade, concerns on economic growth. There is that vol risk premium that is a very typical thing in equity land. The VIX or implied vol outstrips the realized with a fair amount of consistency. How do you think about just the world of option prices as you look at the landscape at this point?
probably in the neighborhood of appropriate right now. I mean, you're right. FX fall is really low. It's low for a reason, because we have a lot of central bank certainty right now. I'm sitting here trying to think of a central bank that I don't think I have a really good beat on their policy for the next 12 months. And I don't think there's one. I think we know where we're going to get out of Lagarde. I think we certainly know where we're going to get out of the Fed. And like they've told you, the bar to either raise or lower is incredibly high right now. So, a lot of certainty around there. BOE may be the one that's a bit of an outlier. The BOJ will try to do stuff, but they'll be ineffective as always. Yeah, I guess PBOC could surprise somebody, but if the trade deal starts going sideways, they won't tell anybody first. so that could be a bit of a shock. But things aren't moving. Like everybody has a lot of certainty about what central banks are going to be doing, because the communication has been reasonably clear. It's not really a bad thing. It just means there's other stuff that we can be looking at. So FX may not be the release channel or the release valve for stress that it has played for the last couple of years. Rates similarly, like for the same reasons, but pretty much like we think rates are probably stuck about where they are. So, equities is probably the release valve right now for any trade tensions or anything kind of weird going on. And the playbook we've been using on the trade side is reasonably straightforward. I still think it's in the best interest of both parties to get something done. We still think that's the most likely outcome. But it's not a 90-10 thing. It's like a 60-40 thing maybe. And the thing that we're watching on China's side to see if we think they're going to change their mind, we're watching their currency fixes. That's a big deal for Trump. And it's a very political thing for them on the currency side. So long as they don't do anything really kind of devaluation-y with their currency. Is that a word? Yeah, devaluation-y. Yeah. As long as they don't do anything like that, we think they're still probably on board. And so long as Trump doesn't call President Xi a nickname on Twitter, in all seriousness, if you think about how Trump has dealt with his political foes over the past couple of years, the bar for him to call, to brand somebody with a pejorative nickname on Twitter isn't real high, which is what it is. He's markedly not taken that tact with the president of China. And we think it's because he thinks the personal relationship with President Xi is important to getting something done, kind of like the Reagan-Gorbachev dynamic. So long as he continues to be kind of courteous to the man, like he's tough on the country, but as long as he's courteous to the man himself, like we think that's actually a pretty important marker towards how he's thinking about, do I want to get something done or not? So far, he's still being pretty nice to him on Twitter and in public remarks. We're still holding this same position that we think that it's more likely than not. But it's anybody that tells you they had a real good beat on it is pulling your chain. It's a probabilistic game we're playing. We think we have an idea about it, but it's tough.
I wanted to get your insights on portfolio construction just broadly. I think it's rare that a crisis occurs and an investor says, boy, I'm more diversified than I thought. I have less risk than I thought. It tends to be that we underestimate how much risk we have, how high correlations can become. We probably overestimate liquidity. And we're in this incredibly low vol world. It's not likely to change. Low rate world, I should say. It's not likely to change for a long time. You've talked about Horizon's efforts on behalf of its clients to manage money for the long term. How does a firm like yours adjust to an environment where your money, unless you take a fair amount of risk, is not going to earn you much? How does that impact how you guys construct portfolios?
Yeah, it's something we've been spending a ton of time on, actually. So we essentially have a few different risk mitigation techniques that we avail ourselves of. We have some things that are basically take advantage of low volatility investing. We have some strategies that are more options-based in the way they deal with risk. We have some dynamic allocation strategies that act as kind of a moving stop loss kind of dynamic. The trick to us really is combining them, because you just like these different strategies, these different risk mitigation techniques are going to work differently in different types of markets. So if you just break the world up into up market, down market, sideways market, and define them however you want, a dynamic allocation technique is going to work very differently in a sideways market than low vol investing or than an options-based approach. And those things work very differently in a down market or an up market as well. And so the trick really isn't calling the right risk mitigation strategy for all times. It is really combining these different techniques into a package that we think is relatively robust to whatever kind of market we get. So for instance, we've had V markets. So a down market followed by a sharp up market. We've had three of these sharp Vs over the last 3 years. And by sharp, I'm saying greater than 10%. We had three of them over the last 3 years. And that's It's not, you know, if you look back over the last 40 years, we haven't had that kind of market. I mean, we haven't had three in a three-year period ever. It's a very unusual kind of dynamic. So is that what we're going to have going forward? I don't know. But if it is, then you need a very different risk mitigation technique than if you're managing risk, say, in the 90s or in the mid-2000s. So I don't know what's coming next. Like, and we're not that smart to figure out like what kind of market we're going to get going forward. So the best thing we can do is try to have risk mitigation techniques that are fairly orthogonal to one another in the way they behave. So they're going to behave differently at different times. And just try to build approaches and portfolios that utilize all of them. Maybe emphasize one over another at different periods of time, but ultimately, like, not try to get too cute with it. Just avail ourselves of all the different tools that we think we can, because the risk mitigation problem is a tough one.
When you think about putting portfolios together and think about the elements in the portfolio, they have their individual risk and return attributes, and then they have the correlation matrix that they form together. And so, of course, whenever we measure a correlation, we're looking behind us. We wouldn't look behind us unless we thought there was some value there. We think that there's some tendency for a correlation relationship to persist, but there are times when they could just be regime dependent. I go back to stocks and bonds in the 80s and even really through the mid 90s, stock and bond prices positively correlated. And then certainly in the post-crisis period, but even before that, I would say after 2000, you started to see more of this risk on, risk off relationship and regime. And then you have portfolios that largely get built upon this assumption. How do you balance the value of data and understanding historical relationships with the reality that they may be time varying and time dependent?
Like the million-dollar question, Dean. It's hard. Like I don't think I've got anything very smart to say about that other than almost just reiterate what I just said about having a process or thing that's something that's robust to the different types of environments you might find yourself. Because real quick example, look at low vol investing. Low vol investing over the last 5 years has beaten the S&P 500 by like 20 percentage points, like 2,000 basis points. Something crazy. The S&P is up 70. Low vol is up 90, something like that. That's not an expected outcome. So just do low vol all the time, right? Hey, market's up, you're doing great. Market's down, you got protection. Well, I mean, if you look at low vol in like the mid to late 90s, you trail by 140 percentage points. And, you know, like, you know, 14,000 basis points, something silly, right? With the same kind of like return dynamics. I mean, you know, market up pretty strong, like similar kind of Fed environment. Like a lot of the things were sort of similar, but low vol investing got crushed in the 90s and has killed it over the last 5 years. And so what's next for that? I don't know. I do know that we think there's long-term value in having an approach like that, but to put all your eggs in a basket, probably not the right approach. Just like having, you know, like this idea of like, are correlations going to be persistent through time with stocks and bonds? I don't really know, but I do know that we can build approaches that are robust to whatever kind of correlation environment we find ourselves in, to the best of our ability, and then have the ability, hopefully the smarts to be able to adjust if one of the assumptions that we have building this process end up being wrong. That's a cornerstone for having some adaptability in your process, which nowadays we think is really important.
As 2020 approaches and you think about the risks, some of which are just unknowable and unhedgeable, maybe a cyber attack of some kind, there's just things we just can't account for. But there are things that are either on the calendar, things like elections and political change. There's positioning in the market. There's the economy. What are the things that keep you up mostly that could be disruptive and cause harm to the portfolio?
As far as kind of the known stuff, there's always the chance that you get something bad that nobody could ever predict, like a terrorist kind of thing. Outside of stuff like that, the stuff that we sort of, things that we think we know about right now is clearly the election. I mean, the trade is definitely one. If trade really goes sideways, that would end up being problematic. We don't think that's going to happen, but that would be if it did. The other one is ultimately the election. The election is only going to matter if the Democrats nominate basically Warren, Sanders, and possibly Buttigieg. Like, we don't know enough about the guy yet. So if it becomes a real probability that some of these policies come into play, and again, I'm not making a value judgment on the policies, whether they're good or bad for the society, but we know that Warren's policies are unabashedly bad for financial markets. They're bad for asset prices. They decrease flexibility for firms and the economy. They decrease the earnings per share, and they're going to make those two things. You know, and decreasing flexibility is going to mean that you decrease multiples. You become more like Europe. Those things are going to be bad for asset prices. if we get an environment where it looks like it's going to be she versus, you know, she Sanders or possibly Buttigieg against Trump, okay, now we got something we need to start thinking about and start pricing. You can't price that stuff before Super Tuesday, which I think is March 3rd. So we get to that point, like it's probably kind of a non-issue, but it's like what things that are on our radar for 2020, and that's certainly one of them. But we have been talking, you know, I do speeches with clients a lot, and started getting election questions in October, which I was like, I got 13 months to talk about this. This is going to be great. You know, one thing I have been saying is if it's Bloomberg or Biden, just like buy everything with both hands, because then like this big tail risk thing is off. And Biden's pretty darn liberal. Like he's not the moderate that people think he is, but it is all relative. And it would be a big relief. So that would be a kind of buy everything you can get your hands on.
What in terms of the types of areas of research and things that you guys are excited about that are kind of in the lab for you and your team that you can talk about? And again, as you think about this world that is changing so quickly, but has got some really distinct markers of low rates, don't seem to be going away anytime soon, low rates and low growth. What are the types of strategies and kind of areas of investigation that you feel are most promising right now?
I think the world is moving in more of a goals-based or outcome-based frame especially for individual investors. And so that is one kind of large area of research that we're certainly pioneering that we're really excited about. But within that space, probably the biggest area of research that we're doing and frankly a lot of other large firms are doing right now is it's under the umbrella of how do I solve a zero rate retirement problem? So how do I solve a financial planning problem for somebody in retirement with rates at either zero or very, very low? It's a problem that hasn't really been solved adequately yet. One way you're going to solve that is through the incorporation of either structured notes or annuities, some sort of insurance products with managed portfolios or with managed accounts. So like, how do I combine insurance and managed money together? How do I think about that? How do I think about the trade-offs? How's the math work? If we want to bring in efficient frontiers, like how do you think about efficient frontiers in that context? That broad kind of spectrum is a place where we think there's a lot of energy. It's a pretty interesting space because the structured note and annuity world is a very defined outcome kind of product. But if you think about the prior 10 years is really the age of product. There's an ETF for everything. There's a note for everything. There's an index for everything. Like there's so many indexes and ETFs and other products out there. There's something for anything that you want to do. Nobody knows how to use them. So the last 10 years were the age of product. Like we think the next 10 years are going to be the age of planning. And financial planning is you have to pair products with a plan and track it through time. And that's really what goals-based investment management is. And so this telling people how to use or informing people how to use these products. Like you've got a product for everything, but how do you use it? How do you track it? How do you think about it? How trade-off looks like inside of a portfolio? That's where we think the real kind of drive is going to be, and especially on the retirement asset side. And it's a pretty interesting area of innovation that we and a lot of other firms are really diving into pretty hard right now.
It seems as the world ages and even as the U.S. population ages, this is going to be a really significant area to focus on. We know some of the stats, which are unfortunate about the amount of savings that the average person has later in life. So it makes the planning part all the more valuable. And kudos to you and your firm for focusing on an important issue there, not just money management, but getting people through that period of retirement.
Because nobody knows how to think about it. Like I literally had this conversation with my mom about 3 months ago. It was trying to figure out how much of a particular annuity to use, how much of a managed account kind of like withdrawal type of strategy to use. And for us, it comes down to a system of trade-offs, frankly, everything else in life. But it's defining what those trade-offs are and then talking about, hey, mom, so which do you care more about, legacy assets or inflation protection or the big G guarantee on your income or, you know, your ability to get to the money at some point if you need it or, you know, whatever this set of trade-offs are. It's some number of questions that you can ask a real person and never use a Greek letter, which is fantastic because mom doesn't want to talk about Greek letters and she doesn't want to talk about exposures to small cap value or anything like that. She just wants to know if she's on track or off track. She wants to know how much of each of these things do I need? Like they both are good and they have very complementary types of qualities, but nobody will tell her how much of each to use because there's no framework yet. And so like we feel really passionately about this, the figuring out like how to tell mom what to do or at least give her a framework within which to make the decision herself or how to think about it. Because once they understand what the system of trade-offs are and kind of what that means for their portfolios and their selections and kind of what their investments look like, all of a sudden they're connected to their portfolio. They understand why they've got this much of this and this much of that. And with connected to your portfolio and you're not being talked to in terms of Sharpe ratios and Greeks that nobody really cares about, frankly, then when the crisis happens or when something bad happens in markets, you don't freak out and you stay the plan. And the best thing you can do as an individual investor is have a plan and have an investment program that matches it and track it through time and be able to stick with it. And you do that when you understand things.
Well, it's great to be able to use the financial expertise to solve important objectives on behalf of your clients.
Especially mom.
Especially mom, exactly. And your mother-in-law,
yeah,
too.
Too.
It was great to have you on today. It was a fantastic conversation. Thanks a lot, Scott.
I appreciate it, Dean.
You've been listening to The Alpha Exchange. If you've enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. And before we leave, I wanted to invite you to drop us some feedback. As we aim to utilize these conversations to contribute to the investment community's understanding of risk, your input is valuable and provides direction on where we should focus. Please email us at feedback@alphaexchangepodcast.com. Thanks again, and catch you next time.